Welcome to Side by Side, a podcast where I, Robert Kwong, take you inside conversations with artists, creatives, healers, and warriors taking the charge in their transformational story. Today's guest is Antim Miller, an internationally sought-after performer and composer who maintains a rigorous international creative presence. They began studying cello at the age of 8, and later focused on early music performance, musicology, as well as modern and Baroque cello at McGill University in Montreal. In this conversation, we dive inside Antim's early discovery of classical music, their approach to composition and arrangement, and some of the harsh realities and blessings of pursuing a career in music. All right, Antim. First of all, I love that name.
Thank you.
And like I said earlier before we started recording, it's really nice to be chatting with a fellow musician as always, and also a composer, which is really fun. It always makes me curious to get into how you got interested in playing the cello and how you were inspired. Did you grow up in a family that was also musical? How did it happen?
Well, so my family wasn't necessarily musical. My family was certainly creative. Like we always had like a knack for creative problem solving. In fact, I think that's true for a lot of working class people, learning how to do more with less, for instance. But musically, no. I'm certainly the first professional musician in my family. My sister and my grandfather both played the violin. My sister doesn't really play anymore, but she was largely the reason why I chose the cello. Because I knew I wanted to play a string instrument. I knew I couldn't copy her.
right.
Funny enough, when I was 5 or 6, I got an allowance and I went and I bought 2 CDs. And one of them was like, there were 2 like compilation CDs back in the days when you could buy 2 CDs at Walmart for less than $5. They were The Best of Beethoven and Piano Classics. Like just 2 very generic compilations. And one of the pieces on The Best of Beethoven was the A Major Cello Sonata. And I was like, oh, wow, I was hooked. So that was kind of.
Yeah. So classical music specifically, too. I mean, it makes sense with the string instruments. That's what you get your place to shine.
It's kind of wild, too, because like, I guess my first foray into music was church music. I grew up in the Lutheran church, and they have really, really, really good hymns. I wouldn't consider myself a member of the Lutheran church anymore. But I do have a really soft spot for liturgical music in all of history. But yeah, it was really kind of unprompted. I can't exactly remember why I chose those CDs. Yeah, it was a slippery slope, let's put it that way.
Did thoughts and aspirations around composition happen around the same time, or did that follow a little bit later after you started playing?
No, actually. It took, I think I don't come from a place, it took a long time for me to start composing. I was not particularly interested in composing until my early 20s. In fact, I went to school originally to be a musicologist. I was really, really, really fascinated. There were a couple of lives of composers, specifically Beethoven and Tchaikovsky, that I was, you know, I think a lot of teenagers have these like intense fixations on things. And Tchaikovsky was my fixation. And then I got to school and I realized, this is a hot take. I realized that a lot of musicologists hate music because a lot of musicologists end up going to school to be performance majors and then find out for whatever reason that like, oh, they just don't like being a performer is like really difficult. And so you want to stay in the world of music, but like you sort of have to accept the second best. And a lot of them end up being quite bitter, or at least that was my experience with a handful of them. And that's kind of a painting with a very broad brush, I realize.
Yeah, sure.
But I switched to early music performance, where I studied Baroque cello and viola da gamba. And I also started musically directing shows. And I had also had like a little bit of a background in acting. It was mostly like a avocation, kind of like an elevated hobby. And getting involved in theater, I started composing incidental music for plays. And then I started doing musical direction for musicals and coaching singers. And from there, I was like, oh, interesting. Okay, so I can compose. And then when I started doing like bar gigs and cabaret things, covering songs and like learning how to arrange music for my voice, for my, like to accompany myself singing, I was like, oh, okay, this is something that I can do. And so that around, I say when I first moved to, maybe actually, no, it was a little bit before I moved to New York City when I was still in Montreal that I started composing, around 19.
Do you have any memories of like your early attempts? I mean, this is kind of a funny thing to ask people because, you know, it's like I've asked writers like the first scene that they remember sharing with someone or the first scene that they felt like, this is my first written piece. Do you remember the early memories and what that was like going through that?
Wow. Yes, some of them. I'm trying to think if there was anything before, because there was this one like ridiculously simple piano piece. I mean, very typical Alberti bass, da 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 da. Kind of like Jan Tiersteny, like just very pleasant, very tonal. And yeah, my friend in Montreal, had told me this story about when she was growing up that she fostered a baby raccoon and then her father took the raccoon away and the raccoon returned. Like the raccoon came back to her house. And so I was very inspired by that. And I wrote this. I mean, it's funny because it's like, it could be about anything. It's just this like kind of plaintive A flat major melody. But yeah, that's my, and then I recycled it for a John Patrick Shanley play that I did a couple years later.
It's funny listening to people talk about their own compositions, because again, I haven't really been able to like deep dive with another quite like this, but I took the time to check out your SoundCloud, which has so many tracks. So I, you know, didn't listen to everything, but I wrote down a couple that I was like, this is based off of like first impressions. I was like, ooh, this, I don't know, resonates strongly, but I really liked
my Mountain. Sound. I haven't looked at that ever.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Not to trigger you. So we'll see. Cause I, you know, I don't know your memory of these pieces, but I liked Mountains.
That's pretty great. Yeah. I've played that pretty recently.
Oh really? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I loved that kind of like sonic texture anyway. And also too, I think earlier compositions, Let Us Go Out into the Starry Night. They look like earlier compositions, but I like them. So I thought I would share with you. Like I wrote them down.
Oh, that's so kind. Thank you. Yeah. Where Aware is the, actually, I'm trying to think which is first, the raccoon piece or Where Aware? So Where Aware is the first piece of solo cello music that I ever wrote. Probably around 2010? No, 2011, because I wrote it in Washington Heights, where I could hear the sound of the George Washington Bridge. And it's supposed to be like an abstract exploration of ambient noise, because the two sounds that the place where I grew up in Glens Falls, New York, upstate New York, we lived close to I-87, so you would hear these like 18 wheelers exiting the highway and going, and you would hear that on the George Washington Bridge as well, but you would also hear like wildly different ambient noises, like cicada upstate and like people arguing over dominoes and in Washington Heights.
I love the early compositions, and you clearly have like a musical theater background experience as well because of the way that you would compose and do like kind of soundtrack music for a poem or some kind of live theater, some kind of theater piece and things like that. So because I also have that background, I find like doing interdisciplinary creative works like that to be like really fun and fulfilling. But I'm curious, is when you do all these different things, because, you know, you do arranging, you do just pure composition, and amongst other things, like, are they, do you approach them all super differently? Or what is your process depending on what's being asked of you? How different is it?
That's a good question. How do I approach them differently? I mean, so to your point about interdisciplinary things, just like, that's the name of the game. Like, those are the, for me, the best collaborations. I mean, I think I learned early on through, you know, trial by fire, that like the most valuable collaborations are with people with whom you share really, really deep creative and process differences, because the way that you grow as an artist is by reconciling those differences. That can be very difficult, and it really tests one's ability to collaborate. And also, like, you don't want to collaborate with somebody who agrees with you on everything. So that's one answer, or at least one part of the question. But like the way I approach, I mean, so a lot of people will compose when they're inspired. I can count on one hand the number of pieces that I've composed from a stroke of inspiration. I compose when I'm commissioned and have a to-do list. And that makes it a lot clearer and easier. Sometimes I talk about creative work in a way that comes off to people as very, like, maybe clerical and sterile. But that's only because I like, I don't, it's, this is a weird thing to say, but like, it's not, I don't like music. I like ice cream. I like pizza. Like, if I, music is like a hygienic thing, it's my job. And I can also kind of rely and take for granted my like deep and personal emotional relationship to it. So like trying to like quantify that is useless and a waste of time. I also, well, for instance, right now, I am working on a film score. I'm doing like a collaborative film score with two other musicians. It is premiering in like 48 hours. It's a live film score for the German Expressionist film, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Oh, and that's right. That's going to happen tomorrow, right?
Yeah, 2 days, on Sunday.
Oh, in 2 days.
And I mean, that process is very much like figuring out how to, so rather than try and respond to something that's going on the screen, trying to create an atmosphere that kind of like creates a, yeah, like create an atmosphere or a vibe, rather than to be like, oh, okay, he's doing that, so let's play that or respond to it, or like kind of like not choreograph, but I think you might know what I mean. Creating a vibe to like support rather than mimic.
Well, yeah, the music term I'm thinking of is embellishment, but not in a shallow way. Like, it's really supposed to add some of the sparkle and the just enhance the vibe a little bit on the edges. And it's why I love soundtracks and scores, really.
I really do. Especially horror film scores.
Oh, interesting. Actually, that's something I wanted to ask you, is like, it doesn't have to be like early on, but just overall in your life, what have been some like composers or scores and things that where you were like, I wish I had written that, or it just really inspired you? And also, oh, I wish I want to score this, you know, those reactions.
Oof. Wow. Well, I mean, so the first one was probably Chopin Heroic Etude. Revolutionary, I think that's called, the Revolutionary Etude. I remember it was on that compilation CD, the Piano Classics, and it was just like, I think it was an old recording, so it was maybe like Horowitz, and it just blew my fucking mind. Am I allowed to curse?
Yeah, of course. Vladimir, you're allowed to curse for Horowitz. You know, I remember some of his recordings that remain undefeated. Yeah.
No. That one, and I mean, I was, we're talking like, I'm listening to these things for the first time, like very, very young. I also used to really, really get into the third movement of Moonlight Sonata. Now it's like so basic, but
yeah, no.
For like 7 year old me, I was like, yeah. I Beethoven was very much my first love, and of course the A major cello sonata that really got me. Then I think later on, one thing that I like really wish I scored, and I am unapologetically and unironically so into this opera, but I downloaded, do you remember LimeWire?
Yes. Yeah.
So I was literally like trying to find new music because I was like kind of stuck in this like classical music rut. So I was like, jazz, punk. And then I did minimalism and I got the greatest hits of minimalism. But the one that really fucking got me, I found a piece from the first act of John Adams' opera Nixon in China. It's where the plane lands, the landing of the Spirit of 76. And it okay. was the most exciting, most sensational thing. And I still, it's my favorite opera. I love it so much. I love John Adams very, very much.
Oh, man, you're making me nostalgic now because it's, you know, classical music and gushing about classical music is like a niche conversation, I guess. I don't always do it because no one will know what the F you're talking about. But I had early on, I bought a CD that was Vladimir Ashkenazi. And I believe it was like two concertos. It was Rock 3 and Prokofiev 3rd piano concerto.
Oh,
no
my
big
God.
Deal.
The third.
Like,
right, so good.
And it was like, it was in one album, Prokofiev and Rachmaninoff. And I was like, are you kidding me? This shouldn't be humanly possible. And I think, I'll admit, like in college, I think I tried to learn a part of the Prokofiev movement. I was like, impossible. Are you kidding me? What is this? Anyway, so that's, but those early recordings, man, Glenn Gould, the Ashkenazi, the Horowitz, it's just like so good.
Wait, one little sidebar about Prokofiev's Third Piano Concerto. Another kind of just like life-changing experience. My favorite pianist is Martha Argerich.
Yes, love her.
She did this recording when she was much younger. I mean, she can still play it. I mean, she's in her 80s now and she's still really rocking it. But she did this recording with Andre Previn, I forget which orchestra. I mean, it's flawless. It's incredible. And her, I mean, she's got incredible forearms. Her octaves are just like her hands become blurry. But at the end of the first movement, she ends and then she just sits like this and she looks up at Andre Previn and like kind of rolls her eyes in this like kind of smoldery, angsty way. And I'm like, to be able to bottle that kind of like sass and energy.
Oh my gosh, Martha. I mean, she is a master and a class all in her own. I don't know how she's retained her technique because, you know, she'll be able to do the most amazing things with the worst posture. Like, don't try to imitate that. But it doesn't really matter because she can literally play probably any piano piece that's been composed if she really wanted to. I mean, that is on another level.
Truly.
And when you talk about performance and the struggle in that, I am curious, though. I want to deep dive a little bit about your comment about music and the jadedness that can occur for musicians as we navigate this path.
Sure.
What makes the world and the industry of music challenging? Like, unpack a little bit of like, I don't know that I like music all that much. I feel like there's something real there.
I mean, I'm going to be totally frank with you. If I had any ounce of sense or choice, I would not be a musician. Like, I'm totally serious. There are moments where there are fully like weeks of my life where I cannot afford food. It is so hard, especially in New York City. Like, and it can be one bit of circumstance or another, and it's not. It's just reality. And like I said, if I had any ounce of choice, and I fully have tried to do other things, and it is not right for me. This is like, this is what I need to do. And that's not a romantic proclamation. It is literally just the circumstances of my life. And I frankly don't care if it doesn't sound romantic. And it's also really good advice to anybody listening who thinks that they want to be an artist. Like, you don't need to be a professional artist to be an artist. Like, yes. If you can do literally anything else, do it. It will still be there and your bills will be paid. I mean, that's one element of what's difficult. The other thing is, we live in a country that is, I have absolutely no love for this country. I've also been super fortunate to be able to have contracts internationally, and other countries have this funny habit of publicly subsidizing art.
Right. So, like, there's more funding.
So it would be nice to not live here. And eventually I think that's kind of the goal. But right now, I love it here. For all of the shit that I have to deal with, there's, you know, 60% more roses and opportunities, and also like my friends and my family, and like, and also I meet new people every single day. You know, people are still coming here because it is very much a like creative artistic mecca that is just, it just so happens to be merciless. And I mean, it really tends to come down to money. I don't experience, and maybe this is just my personal experience, I don't experience a lot of like cutthroat competition. It might also be that because I'm in a lot of different spheres simultaneously, I'm just not seeing it that much. I'm also like, you know, I am in orchestras. But of the orchestras that I'm in, I've been asked to be in them. I haven't auditioned. The audition circuit can be really, really cutthroat, and should be. These are in demand positions, and so I understand it being cutthroat. But what's nice, at least in my experience, when I was really taking a bunch of like professional orchestra auditions, like top tier ones, I would regularly be auditioning with a handful of colleagues and friends, and we would share fingerings. Mm-hmm. We would talk about what things we were dealing with our audition materials, and like, you know, we would support one another, and I love that.
Yeah, you know, I do consider myself a musician, but I haven't had to experience the circuit in so many ways. So, but as a writer, I have. And I think it, you know, you can find amazing communities where, yeah, you may be going for the same thing, for the same grants, wherever you can find it. But they're also the same group who will help you workshop and do a reading so that you can improve on your voice and this piece you really care about. Yeah. Like you say, the roses part is really like the memories you can make with the people, you know, that kind of understands you, and that's priceless. But also there's a reality of some of the harsh realities of trying to make it as an artist in this world. Yeah. And really wanted to highlight what you said about in other areas, it's not quite like this. There are different circumstances based on funding and sponsorship and just different opportunities that in the United States it just seems to be continually moving away from. And I hope that can hopefully change in the future. But in thinking about like the art of arrangement, I was curious about this because I enjoyed many masterworks and some of the projects that you're doing. And this is kind of like a abstract question, but the art of arrangement, if you could like try to convey or explain to people what it is, I'm curious, how would you like teach people to be able to reinvent something and reinvent themselves? Because to me, like the art of arrangement is trying to take something and reintroduce it. In some ways, I kind of felt that way with many masterworks. So kind of an abstract question, but I would throw it out to you.
So like the thing that got me into composition was arranging. I would arrange like jazz standards that I would sing and play. And I think that kind of arrangement is very different. It comes from the same muscle, kind of the same creative place, but I think the process is quite different than what I did for many masterworks, because I think the re-envisioning and the reintroduction is a good word, the revisiting, the restructuring of a piece is more arrangement. What I do for many masterworks is much more a reduction rather than arranging. Because like, yeah. I've been using this anecdote. If I were to arrange the Eroica Symphony for recorder quartet, that would be an arrangement. Because we're using a similar instrumentation, it's much more of a reduction. So rather than saying, okay, so that opening melody, da 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 da, in the cellos, you know what? Let's give it to the oboe. That would be arrangement. It stays in the cello. And now for that piece, God, that took so fucking long. You have to figure out, okay, so I have nine musicians. Who isn't doing, and I have nine musicians and I have six of them doing something right now. And there are X number of lines. Is there somebody who can do two things at once? String players, for instance, can play double stops. Is there, this was a very difficult one, but in the instance of like fugues, is there a line that can be cut off before it's finished so that another entrance can come in so that you can maintain important entrances? That was like, I felt like I had the ghost of Beethoven like like lording over me. I literally have a portrait of Beethoven hanging over my bed. So it's like this like ever looming specter of just like, don't fuck it up. The other thing is like, yeah, it's fully like a reduction. And by reduction, I mean like you're taking something that is for, you know, I think, is it 18 musicians? You're reducing it by, you know, 15%. Is it 18? Well, yeah, because it might be 18 instruments, but then you have multiple lines per instrument. Yeah, I can't. Right. Exactly. Yeah, the Beethoven.
That's tricky.
But so the thing is, you know what was much trickier? And this has less to do with arrangement. I'm actually quite good at arrangement because the intuition, if you are familiar with the material, like your intuition, like is, you should trust it. A lot of times, for instance, I would not give a bassoon line to a flute. I would much prefer to give the bassoon line to a viola or even like a lot of times the French horn. So too, you wouldn't give a flute line to the cello because it would often mess up voice leading. That was another big challenge, is figuring out how to maintain the voice leading.
So is there a lot of like listening to recordings, pencil in hand kind of action?
Honestly, no, it was a lot by sight. I did, but believe it or not, I would make some notes, but most of it was as it went. Right, I did not listen to a lot of recordings. I also have a pretty intense like visual auditory, like it's I can hear pretty well.
Do you have perfect pitch?
No, I have. Okay. I can like sing. I have pretty excellent relative pitch. I thought I had it for a while.
Yeah.
Like I can sing an E flat. Like
right. No, I used to cheat because I used to whistle in like an A.
everybody can sing 440. And it's funny because if I'm like working on Baroque music, my yeah. like internal A will go down to A 415 or 392. So I'll go to like Baroque pitch.
Yeah, no. I wanted to ask because genuinely this is nerdy for me. I find like outside of during the pandemic, discovering that I did in fact wanted to improvise more, and then eventually led me to be like, well, I could try to like nail down some of these ideas towards composition, but it's all felt like it's inside of like a silo because of the times that it happened. So it's really nice to connect with like other people who think in this way. For example, when you talk about arranging, I thought it was more like similar to like a transcription, but it's not. It sounds actually a little more nuanced.
I mean, yeah, actually well, here's the thing. I wasn't trying to reinvent Eroica.
Yeah.
I certainly had the license to, I could have put a flute line in the cello, for instance. I could have made aggressive choices, but I was not interested in doing that because the Eroica is a masterpiece.
It's pretty well written.
there are certain purists who might even say, like, oh, why are you arranging it in the first place? And sure. And there are fully are some, and I'm just like, well, don't come.
right.
That's right. Fine. Go fuck yourself. But like the whole ethos of Mini Masterworks is to make something like Eroica more accessible. And actually, I was very, very pleased at how effective the first and second season were at bringing in people who had never seen a classical music before, ever. Right. including some people who said that they were finally like interested in classical music who might not have been interested before. That's like,
yeah,
that's profound. That's very cool. And something that some like big tier orchestras like salivate over. So that was
I love that because I think it also is one way that we can try to address the fact that classical music was composed once upon a time. And there's always that discussion, at least I know with fellow classical musicians, like how do you modernize it? How do you find a new audience for something that's been around for so long and so many performances of the same piece? And I do think it does come with trying to be a little bit subversive sometimes in this way, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and it does make me want to ask you, you know, knowing that you are a queer person, you're very out and proud about that. How do you reconcile with the fact that, you know, you're also working on a medium traditional type of music that's a little bit dated? Like, how do you try to bring it into the modern age? Is it through something like arrangements and different projects like this? What's your perspective on it?
I mean, first of all, and this is the most important thing, is hire other queer people. Prioritize other queer people, specifically queer people of color. And like that is easily the best way that you can do it. And it's also a very genuine one because there are plenty of fabulous musicians. That's probably the most immediate way that just like immediately comes to mind is just like give them money. otherwise, I mean, it feels like a cop-out answer, but it's like leading by example. I mean, so like I grew up in a relatively rural town that is like a drop of purple in a sea of red politically. I mean, so, you know, walking around, I'm going to use this word very specifically and forgive me if it's like a little triggering for some people, but like walking around as like an unapologetic faggot in Glens Falls is a political move.
Right.
Because being queer is not a sexuality. Being queer is a political ideology. Being like living this life is dangerous sometimes. And I think that in and of itself, honestly, it's not enough, but some days it just has to be.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm always looking to like find good like stories to tell. I'm currently, it's been on the back burner because of like largely because of Mini Masterworks, but I have a story that I'm going to try and develop with my theater company about like senior queer people. Like I have this, I have this interesting story idea. I don't want to say too much about it.
Sure.
Involving a woman in a care facility and her nurse, that I am slowly developing. Also, like, that's a kind of queer story that we don't hear that often. Yeah, that is a good question.
Yeah.
To be honest, I think that's, I mean, it's something that I think about a lot, and I don't know if I've answered it.
No, I love hearing other people's perspective on this, and thank you for sharing it. Because the first answer that you gave was one that I thought was so obvious, but to be honest, that wasn't even like the first thought I had, which is like, who are the people in the room? Like, who are the players? Who are the musicians? Who gets to be in the audience? Yeah. That's a very, very obvious place to start, and I think that's like the most powerful place to be. And, you know, truthfully, it wasn't until like a few years ago that I even heard and was introduced to composers like Black neoclassical composers and just got to hear more experimental work that falls under that interesting category of like neoclassical or like, you know, 21st century classical. And I was like, I didn't know we were allowed to do this. I didn't know we were allowed to just like, just do this until I saw it at some concert because it wasn't following any of the traditional classical forms, but clearly we know where the origins are and where their training and the musicians involved are coming from too. So anyway, and that was only like a few years ago. I had no exposure.
You know what's wild? I'm glad you mentioned that because I need to really revisit this, but I saw on Instagram. So like I need to preface this by saying I saw this on Instagram. Please rigorously fact check this. But the Baroque dance suite forms, so like Allemande, Sarabande, Gieg, all of these very, very, very Western classical dance forms have origins in Africa. I did not know that. I have to learn some more about that. Just wanted to share that.
Yeah, no, it's, I recently saw a clip of an African cellist playing in a style that I was not familiar with, that was quite vibrant, and they were using kind of,
what is his name? I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, that's the thing, like when these things go viral, I'm always like, and when I need to remember the name, I won't be able to. But it's like, it was a clip that had gone around and I was like,
I think it's awful. Yeah, it's like ABELSELAOCOE. He's fabulous.
Yeah. So it's just, I realized, I think, in talking to you and just in being a musician myself, that the world of music, and apparently even the world of classical music, is in some way can be like bottomless. You know, there's always more that we can try. And I guess I choose to find some hope and positivity in that, you know, as a musician myself.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there is. I really like that. I agree.
So... what are some things that you have coming up that you'd like to share or spotlight? And if people wanted to connect with you online or just look at your body of work, where can they find you?
So I had mentioned I am currently kind of preparing a live score for the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. I'm not sure when this or when this podcast will go out, but it's the 27th of October right now. This will be on the 29th. That I expect to be recorded and available online probably in the next few weeks.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, God willing. Fingers crossed. Lots of moving parts.
Right.
So I am doing, what's next? So I'm doing Rigoletto with the Regina Opera Company. And then I have a couple of musicals. I'm mostly doing pit work, but I am trying to think of the next production I have going, because right now we're doing a lot of like grant writing to get funding for a remounting of a couple of pieces. We want to remount Wellspring. You might have seen Wellspring on SoundCloud.
Mm-hmm.
And I also am applying to some residencies to see whether or not I can, you know, rework some pieces, potentially develop a solo album. I am slowly putting together the budget to do an album solely of like mid 20th century French pop music, like Edith Piaf and Charles Aznavour, because I just like it.
That's so gay. I love that.
You are absolutely correct.
Yeah,
I was like... So I like I would often do a Bastille Day concert. I would do a Bastille Day concert for like every 5 years I did a Bastille Day concert 4 or 5 years every year upstate. And then I moved here and I've only done 2 since then. And there was this small army of French women who would come. and it was so sweet because they kept asking for an album. And I was like, you know what? Fuck, I really should make one. And it would also just be so much fun to make and arrange. If you want to connect with me, there's my website. So my name is Antim Miller. It's AntimMiller.com. And then Instagram is that, Antim Miller Music. Other things? Yeah, I think I'm just doing mostly like other people's pieces. And yeah, I guess soon we're going to talk about Mini Masterworks season two or season three.
Season three, that's right.
Yeah. Season three.
We'll see. You're busy.
It's not bad. I know. I was so jaded. I'm like talking about other musicians, like, don't be a musician, blah, blah, blah. I also fully just came off of like a 3 month period of really busting my ass and like waiting for invoices to be paid. The thing about being a freelancer is like you have these peaks and ebbs. Like I went for so long being so poor. And now I just like, now I paid 2 months rent up front. And like, it's super inconsistent. And I guess that's another thing is like, I'm very, very fortunate that I have like through my partner and my community that I have and my family, like a safety net. I don't have emergency savings. I don't have excellent health insurance. I have though people who are able to like support me in the event that like I do need somebody to like cover like vet care for my cat. Fortunately, knock on wood, that's not been super necessary. I mean, other than the vet care. But that's not the case with a lot of musicians, and it's really like the lack of formal support from the government. And I mean, maybe to be honest, maybe I'm just not seeing it. Maybe I'm not looking hard enough. It could be there, and I'm just not connected.
Well, thank you for your vulnerability and sharing that, because sometimes as artists, we don't like to talk about these things, understandably. Mm. But at the same time, I think, you know, it's okay to talk about those things alongside all the wonderful projects that you're looking forward to.
It's more than okay. It's important. I think one thing that I experience a lot when I'm like really, 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 really stressed out and like pressed by the circumstances of life is that you think you're alone. You feel really alone. And the reality is you're never alone. And it can be, especially for me, it is really hard and embarrassing to ask for help. And help is out there. And I think talking about these sorts of things, it's easy for me to talk about it now. And of course, like, I'm so bad at asking for help. But, you know,
still deserves to be said.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, being able to support each other, I mean, in some instances, we are all we have.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I did a piece of writing that was about ancestors, and it was during a particularly hard week recently, right? And it just made me remember to think about, even in like the lineage of musicians, from teacher to student, that's like a very honored, time-honored thing, which I realize is very specific to musicians. But there's like a lineage, and in thinking about my ancestors, that we are now like the living descendants. Like, we decide where classical music goes. Wow. It's like, you know...
I haven't thought about that in a long time, because you're absolutely right. Like, the family tree of teachers to me, like, wow.
But like musicians, it's like a thing. It's like, who studied with this person.
It like, also gets very tribal.
Yeah, there's pettiness. I'm trying to, like, I don't know if you can see behind me, and also they're poorly drawn, but this is a little bit of tribalism, because I grew up studying... I was like, Debussy, Ravel, I think Brahms here somewhere, because I wasn't very good at impressionist era music. I was better at stuff where I knew where to execute or to aim for in terms of like a technical matter in terms of music. And I did not understand impressionist music. And now I'm just like obsessed with it, because it kind of reminds me of lo-fi minimalist music. So that's where the tribalism comes from, because I think I kind of looked down on it once upon a time. So now I have to pay it back.
It's funny how we go through like those periods of time, because like I also there's a lot of high romantic stuff that I don't like. I'm like, so Sam, I mean, my Mini Masterworks collaborator is like in love with Brahms, and Brahms is great. Brahms is like a monolithic master. Brahms is like, for me, I love, like, there are certain pieces of Brahms that I absolutely love. I will not seek out Brahms to play or listen to. And that's just personal preference. I love Baroque music. I love Renaissance music. And I also love, what's weird is, like, I love, like, really hard grading new experimental music. It's like the contrast is funny, but I didn't love experimental music like 10 years ago. And who knows, in 5 years, I might think it's garbage.
Like Kronos Quartet type of?
Yeah, like, sometimes. I also like, or especially live experimental music or noise music.
Yeah, just kind of like real spontaneous noise making kind of.
I mean, it's because for every like minute of things that are intensely unpleasant to listen to, you have you have 10 seconds of something that you've literally never heard before and is actually very inspiring.
That's such a good way of describing enjoying contemporary music or experimental music. It's like, but if you just wait for it, I promise you.
I know. Like, wait, don't leave. Don't change the channel.
It's not just 20 minutes of like cats. You know, I swear. Anyway, that's so funny. It was such a pleasure to connect with you and team. I'm so glad we got to do it. And this conversation will go up after your Dr. Caligari event, but definitely will be kept in the loop and hope to follow your work. Maybe you can help me find some people to complain about composition to or something, because I also need that community, because it is, I don't know how to talk to other people about it because it's like,
well, it's the same for everything. Practice, 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 honey.
Yeah. Thank you, Antim.
My pleasure. Have a good day.